Our last scripture for 2013 on Sunday mornings is going to be, ready? I know you've been wondering all week, what is Pastor Greg going to speak on for the last Sunday of 2013? Where here it is, ready? Philippians chapter 4, if you want to follow along, it's going to be the fourth chapter of Philippians, and it's going to be verses 10 through 13. I guess lots of times what happens this time of the year is we kind of reassess our lives a little bit, maybe the last year, and what happened that we wanted to happen, and maybe what happened that we didn't want to happen. And what's that? Oh, the poinsettias for 2013, you can take them and have them for 2014. Anybody that donated them, today, if you wouldn't mind just taking them home, because we'll be going back to regular mode after today. We'll be out of holiday season. So please, if you donated one or however many you donated, please take it, all right? It's yours to have. Yeah, Marianne?
Greg, I'm sorry. Can I make a quick announcement?
Sure. Just see Mary Ann if you're interested in that, okay? All right, now we're out of that commercial break. We'll come back to Philippians chapter 4. I was just saying, you know, as you get to the end of the year, you kind of start to reassess things. Sometimes we look at things that we wished would have happened, or maybe we look at things that did happen, and whatever that might be, and so we make New Year's resolutions, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's good. It's healthy to look forward and kind of make goals for yourself. I mean, the Bible talks about that, right? It says a vision. That in Proverbs, it says, without a vision, people perish. So it's healthy. It gives us, it helps us paint a picture of what we want things to look like in the future, and we can work towards those things. It's kind of like a necessary fuel, I think, that we almost need to have as individuals to have some goals for ourselves. Even as a church, we've done that before. But at the same time, I think we all know that we have goals that we don't reach. And lots of times, I think it ends up we break more resolutions than we end up keeping. I kind of thought about it, and I thought, well, you know what, instead of, I've done messages at the end or the beginning of a year, just kind of painting a vision and things that we want to see happen in the year ahead, and that's good, you know, to get us all pumped up about what we want to see and so forth. But this time around, I thought, well, let's look at the fact that there's a lot of goals that haven't happened, maybe that we would have liked to, and there's resolutions that we've broken, and let's talk about that a little bit, and how do we do that if it doesn't happen and the goal isn't hit? I'm not talking about preparing for failure, but I'm talking about being prepared when failure hits, because it happens all the time. It's a reality of this kind of life that we live in this fallen world. And the key is that your contentment isn't wiped out by it. Paul talks about a contentment here that can handle broken dreams, broken goals, things that doesn't really happen the way perhaps you would like to see them happen. And you know what he calls it? He calls it the secret of contentment. You know what I thought of when I first read this? Does anybody remember, like, back around 2006, there was like this book/DVD, man, that everybody was going crazy over. It was called The Secret. Right? The Secret. And everybody, man, and then she got on Oprah and it exploded. I thought, what was that anyway? I went to go look it up. It was some lady named Rhonda Byrne. She sold $300 million worth of merchandise from that secret. I guess it's not very secret anymore. But you know what's interesting? Paul has a secret. Let's check out Paul's secret. The Bible secret, God's secret, and he says it's the secret for contentment. He says that he's learned the secret for contentment. Do you feel contented now? See how that contented music just came in, right? All right, here's what we're going to look at. Let's just read what he says here, okay? Verse 10 of chapter 4 of Philippians. Here's what he says. He wrote, "I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you have renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I am in need. I have learned," listen to this, "I have learned," Paul says, "to be content whatever the circumstances." Verse 12, "I know what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret," there it is, "of being content in any and every situation, even when my resolutions are broken, every single one of them. Whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want." And this is a guy that knew what it was to be on both extremes, huge extremes. Verse 13, "because I can do everything through him who gives me strength." Paul, "I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation." That is some claim Paul is making here. Paul is saying, "I've learned the secret of deep satisfaction. I've learned no matter how crazy circumstances get, whether they're really, really good, which isn't so hard to deal with, or if they're really, really bad, it has no bearing on my emotional equilibrium. My emotional equilibrium is not thrown off by any circumstances." And he's writing this probably from jail to people that knew that he was arrested when he was in their town trying to spread Christianity. He was arrested, thrown in jail, flogged, thrown in shackles in a prison. And he's saying, "You know what? Even when I was in that place, or even when it was a better place, I'm content." Story has it in Acts that when he was in prison, he started singing hymns to God with a bloody back. I was talking about that with Eric. I was like, what kind of condition of heart did this guy have that he could actually have a sense of contentment? It had nothing to do. His circumstances had no bearing on his emotional equilibrium. Man, I want that secret. Let's face it, we're all struggling, right? We got stress, we got deadlines, we've got all these different dates maybe that upsets you, or it could be your lack of dates that is upsetting you. I mean, whatever the case is, right? I mean, it's all coming down on us, and we spend all this money. I mean, I think we would be astounded how much money humanity spends on trying to reach contentment. I mean, that Rhonda Byrne, The Secret, spent $300 million just on that alone. How about if you add yoga or L. Ron Hubbard's Dianetics and all these different things, and not even just the stuff that people put themselves through that maybe we think is a little weird, but I'm talking about solid stuff, good therapeutic counseling or whatever that we spend all this money on, and we're all spending it and striving to reach what Paul says he found. Actually, he didn't say he found it. He said he learned it. It's a process. Wow, I could use that. Paul says, "I've found it. I've learned the secret." I've learned a secret. Here's the deal. Tim Keller mentioned this, something I saw, and I was like, wow, now that's interesting. Christianity does not just offer contentment, it commands it. Listen, if it offered it, it means that maybe a few people could have it. But if it commands it, that means we're all supposed to have it. It says that you shall not covet. You shall not want anyone else's stuff, but love God enough to be content in all circumstances. That's one of the big 10. Actually, it's number 10. You shouldn't want anybody else's stuff, which is implying you need to be content. Not even need to be, I'm commanding it. I don't think God's going to command us to do something that He hasn't wired us to have the capacity to experience or to carry out. Wow. Now, I saw some of the studies on this word covet, and it says it's a really ancient word that we really don't have, especially in the English language, any really good translation for it. Want is the closest we have when you really want something, but it's not the same as covet. Because covet is bad, want is good. You're supposed to want things. God put that in us. Covet is when you inordinately want something so bad that if you don't get it, it makes you miserable. One way I heard it put is, wanting is when you're the dog and the want is in the tail. Coveting is when the want is the dog and you're the tail. The want's in charge. The want's leading you around. It's neck. It's the reason you're depressed, you're unhappy, you're worried, you're upset. The thing underneath it all, because you're coveting something that's taken over. It's like an idol, a competing desire that takes the place that where God belongs. We got plenty of them, and they're fighting for that throne all the time. Now, Paul writes here that we can be freed from this into true contentment. I want to look at three things that I see that he's saying in here. One is, he says, like I just said, that it's a secret. Paul says, I found the secret. The second one is that he says, we can find out whether if we're feeling contented, we can find out if the contentment we're experiencing is really the real thing. And the way we can find out is by two conditions. The conditions of either having plenty or having nothing. There's something that exposes false contentment when either you have absolutely nothing, you're on the street as a homeless person, or your dream is completely fulfilled like a Bill Gates. There's something about those two extremes, either plenty or want, you begin to realize whether the contentment you have was false enough, whether it explodes in the midst of it. Paul says, I passed the test. I've been on both ends of the spectrum, and guess what? I'm content. I found the secret. Actually, he says, I've learned the secret, which is the last thing I want to look at. He doesn't say it was something where he went, aha, you know, it just fell out of the sky. Here it is. I've got the secret. Let's make a DVD. Here you go. 300 million. Thank you, Jesus. No, he says, I've found or discovered the secret of contentment, and it's learned. As a matter of fact, he says it twice because he wants to make sure you understand it's a process. Verse 11, he says, I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. Then he says it again in verse 12, I have learned the secret of contentment. I've learned it. I've learned it. So let's look at that. First one, it's a secret. This is simple and it's not simple, kind of, in a way. It doesn't mean that it's something that God is intentionally withholding from us. It's a secret. You can't know it. Only a couple people. Sorry. You know, what it is it's not obvious. It's not obvious. It eludes all human beings. If you want it, it's there. But he implies that you've got to ask, you've got to seek, you've got to knock. He will find me who seeks me with all of his heart. It's not an obvious thing. It can't be seen. It's there, but it kind of eludes us. And all the great writers and philosophers, and so many of them have talked about it, that there's this something they can't just seem to obtain that gives them full satisfaction. I found a couple of them. Mark Twain wrote this. He says, "You don't know just what it is you really want, but it fairly makes your heart ache. You want it so." Not quite sure what it is, but you don't seem to quite get it. C.S. Lewis, who was an atheist for the first part of his life, knew it very well, said most people, if they had really learned to look into their own hearts, would know that they do want and want acutely something that cannot be had in this world. The wife may be a good wife, and the hotels and scenery may have been excellent, and you may have had a very interesting job, but something has evaded us. Another quote I found was by a guy named Wallace Stevens, who was a poet. I tried reading, I don't know, I'm just not smart enough. You know, I read some of his poems and I'm like, what? You know, what did he say? I know there's something really cool here, but I'm not smart enough to get it. You know, I wish I was, you know. But there was one statement he made. I said, now that's a keeper. I'll use that and I can look really smart, you know. Like I understand Wallace Stevens stuff. He said this, "Even in contentment, I feel the need for some imperishable bliss." That's it. We want stuff that lasts. That's what it is. I get so tired, man. I mean, even Christmas, wasn't it great? And you're right in the middle, and oh, the family's all there. You're opening presents, but you know in the back of your mind, it's going to be over. You know? The imperishable bliss. Why can't we have a bliss that's not perishable? That's what I want. You know, vacation, right? You finally got it together. You get to go away. There you are, whatever it is. Cayman Islands, right? We did that 5 years ago. First time in 25 years of marriage, we said, we are not waiting another five. Right? We said, well, somehow we're trying to work it out now for our 30s, trying to make it happen at least maybe once every 5 years. You're there, and it's like, man, it's great. And then you start winding down, right? There's one day left. It's going to be over, man. It's perishable. You know? A vacation is great, but it ends. You know? A Christmas is great, but it ends. Life can even be great, but it ends. There's something in us that desires something that's permanent, no matter how much we have it. Lewis says, well, geez, if nothing in this world can satisfy my desire for something permanent, maybe it's not found in this world. It's a secret. It's something underneath it all that's crying out to us. Maybe all this stuff that's perishing is trying to call out to us, don't you see your soul wants something that lasts, that's permanent, but it's not in this world. It's a secret, and if you find it, it's Him. It's God. All the love that you experienced, all the approval that you experienced is just a shadow of the actual substance of the thing that awaits you, of God's love, God's approval, God's acceptance. It's a secret, but I'm letting you in on it. I have a DVD in the back, $10. This is God's secret. It all ends up, and it ends up, it's over, but it's hidden. It's underneath it all. You know what a sign of immaturity is? Spiritual immaturity is when you say, you know what it is. It's the next job. It's the next relationship. That's what it is. Yeah, that's what it is. I'm going to... The next thing, the right school, the right look. You got to get the right dream, right? Did you see it? Comes on every Christmas. It was on last week. Climb every mountain. That's what you got to do. Climb every mountain, ford every stream, right? Get your rainbow and follow your dream. That's what it is. You just got to find the right one. You know? So you get there, but what happens if you've climbed the mountain, you've forded the stream, and then you find out it was the wrong one? It ends. It's over. Paul says, we'll go to the next one now, from secret to the next principle. Paul says, there's a couple things, there's a couple conditions that will explode the myth that contentment can come from earthly things. God has sets everything up. He sets all the scientific laws up, right? He's got gravity, what goes up must come. But he set up other laws. And if you try and set up your life on the wrong things, they'll explode on you. And you can't set up. Permanent commitment will not happen if you try and set it on impermanent things, the things of this earth. And there's two conditions that reveal it clearly. He says it here, plenty and want. I've been in plenty. I know what it is to be hungry. And I know what it is to have a Christmas gluttonous celebration. I know both ends. I know what it is, man, to be busted, broke, on the street with nothing. And I know what it is to have it all and be on the Sanhedrin of council in Israel and have the whole deal and admiration and accolades and the whole deal. And I've learned to be content in both areas. But they will explode if you are not set on the right thing. I remember when I was in youth ministry, this is really scary. Because when I say I was in youth ministry, I have to go back at least 20 years ago now. And I still wasn't a youth, but I was old enough to lead the youth at least. Well, sort of lead them. And at that time, there was a big group that all the kids listened to in my youth group, Nirvana. And the big singer of that group, Kurt Cobain, I think was his name, committed suicide. And of course, all the youth pastors want to jump right on that, you know? Well, why do you think he committed suicide, you know? And all the church kids, you know, they're hip, they've heard it all, and they know we're just setting them up to try and blindside them with another sermon, you know? And they're like, oh, I know, you're going to tell us because he didn't have God, right? And there's, you know, there's some truth to that. But I heard one pastor at that time who had a conversation with his son about it. And he answered it with such wisdom. Because, you know, here's his dad, he's a pastor, and he's like, why do you think, you know, this guy Cobain killed himself? And the son's like, well, of course, Dad, you're going to tell me because he didn't know God. And his dad says, well, it's a lot more complicated than that. I mean, there's all kinds of people in the world that don't know God. And they're not all killing themselves. So there's something going on here. And he was able to engage his son in a conversation for a while, not too long, because you can't talk with kids too long about this stuff. But he said a fascinating principle emerged in the midst of it. They were discussing it. And they realized, not all people, there's always exceptions, but there's a huge contingency, a huge group of people that when they actually get to the point that they're so despairing that they at least consider taking their life, that they're at one of these two extremes. They either are in want or they have plenty. They're trying to get to the point, they have their dream, and something comes up, some kind of blockade, something in the way that they realize they are never going to be able to reach their dream. And they become despairing, and they begin to consider taking their life. On the other end, maybe even worse. They thought this was the dream. They thought this was it. Like Kurt Cobain, they got the accolades. They got the popularity. They got the million-selling album. They got all of these things, people screaming their name, and they get there, and they realize this isn't it. And the emptiness of it is overwhelming. Sometimes plenty teaches us more than want. Frightening. Paul says he's been in both places and he's learned the secret of contentment. He's learned the secret. One very cynical lady years and years ago, back when people used to actually buy papers and read them, you know, we didn't take out the phone and look at everything, the Village Voice. And she wrote something very cynical, but there was a truth in it. She said, "Sometimes God grants your deepest wish and you get it. Then he giggles because you realize it's not it and you want to kill yourself." Actually, it should be attributed to the devil. I rewrote it this way. The devil's most effective plan is he grants your deepest wish and you get it, and then he laughs because you realize it's not it and you want to kill yourself. Here's the thing. Most of us don't get plenty or want. Most of us here have never really been without everything and out on the street. Most of us have never experienced fully obtaining our dream. So we're stuck in the middle, and as a result, we can remain stuck in illusion and think that that's still it because we never got it. And people just stay in that place. However, I think a lot of Christians, I find that a lot of Christians are either people who have experienced complete want or the complete success of their dream. Remember Jim Pons? He was just here a few weeks. Only time I got a chance to talk to a guy who really made it in the music industry, you know, as the aspiring guy that had no business trying, but he did anyway, so God felt bad for him and said, "Here, just become a pastor, buddy. You're never going to make a living at the drum." So that's what I did. But I remember Jim saying one time, they got done playing at some club in England, and he was with the Turtles, for those of it you don't know him. Their song had just emerged all the way to number one and actually had dismounted the Beatles' number one hit, Penny Lane. So this guy played in a group that dismounted the Beatles' number one hit of Penny Lane. Only once, but who could say they even did it once, you know? So they got done playing at this club, and their agent said, "There's some guys here that would like to, you know, really wanted to meet you." And he said after the show, they went back through some hallway, zigzagging back, and they came into a room, and there they were, three of the four of them, John Lennon, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr. And there was his inspiration. That was his goal. That was his dream. And the whole time, he said, John Lennon sat there, spaced out, tripped out, staring at the flame of a candle. And it bugged out one of the guys in their band so much, he quit the music industry and became a Christian. Your biggest dream reached. And you realize, that's it. I thought this was it, but that is it, but that's it. Wow, you know? Sometimes plenty shows us even more than want when it comes to this particular. Or we stay in the middle, we never get our dream, and we stay in illusion. I remember somebody wrote in a yearbook, you know how you used to write those things in the yearbook, and somebody wrote under one of the kids' pictures in the yearbook, "You're only young once, but you can stay immature your whole life." You know? Man, spiritually speaking, that can happen. See, when we're in this place where we're going through this thing and you know, we see it's a secret, but then also it's unmasked, or before it's unmasked, if we're caught in the middle, what we do is we blame other things. We try and find things to blame why we're not happy. So we'll blame other things. Here's a few different things. First, we'll blame other things. The reason I'm unhappy is I need a better spouse, a better career, a better figure. I need a nose job. That's what it is, you know. I'll feel better. I know this first dream was wrong, but now I've got the new dream. I'm going to climb the mountain, right? Ford every stream. Now, what this does, a lot of people, is it makes them anxious and driven because they on for certain things and they were disappointed, and it's hard for them to commit to anything. Always changing your life and your career or your look, it makes for a really unstable life. You're always blaming the things. Other people caught in the middle, they don't blame other things. You know what they do? They blame themselves. And what it is, maybe even more so in New York, well, now, Midwestern people are very good at, I mean, I was there for, lived there for 20 years, just everybody acting like they're, everybody's good. Everybody, nobody has any problems, you know? But yet, in yourself, you're like, but man, I'm so unhappy, you know? And so you start to blame, rather than things, you start to blame yourself. Well, maybe there's something wrong with me. Maybe I'm disturbed. You know, and so you want to go to a psychologist and you want to start dealing with your problems. And here's the thing, here's what's a little dangerous. If you do go to a psychologist, and there's nothing wrong with that, it can be very helpful, but you have to be careful because it could be a red herring. In other words, it could be distracting you from the real issue. You have to be careful. So you could just go, and if you want to find out you have issues, guess what? You'll have them. We all do. We're fallen, you know? So you're going to start looking at all of these things, but what you have to understand is this fixes the peripheral, but doesn't deal with the center. Often why we're so depressed, people are depressed, is because they have no meaning. Maybe we need to deepen our connection with God and understanding of meaning if we're already get it. The real issue has to do with our spiritual well-being. We have psychological problems. Here's another guy I found, Ernest Becker. My son laughs at me now. See, now that I got one of those smartphones, I actually forgot to bring it to church today. Isn't that? It's like you panic when you don't have some. But he laughs at me because every time I hear something, I got my phone out and I'm researching it. You know, he's like, "You sweat research, Dad. That's all you do, man." You know, every time a name's mentioned, oh, who is that guy? Oh, he was born in 1898, and he was a poet. So I heard Ernest Becker, who was mentioned in some book, so I looked him up. He's a guy that lived in Hartford, Connecticut, and he was a cultural anthropologist. He studied human behavior, wasn't a believer, but listen to this insight he has. You know what, people? Joel always says, all truth is God's truth. So if Satan says 2 + 2 = 4, it's still truth. And sometimes there's deep truths within what these people study and they come up with. We filter it through the Bible, but sometimes there's great insights. Sometimes it's even interesting when somebody doesn't have the prejudice of being a believer and yet they come up with the same conclusions, because all truth is God's truth. Ernest Becker looks into this danger of psychology where people are looking to fix themselves, but the real fix has to do with the meaning of life, not the peripheral issues. And he says all the psychoanalysis in the world doesn't allow a person to find out who he is, why he's on earth, why he has to die, how he can make life a triumph. And it is when psychology pretends to do this, when it pretends to offer a full explanation for human unhappiness, that it becomes a fraud and it creates an impasse from which you cannot escape. When we look to psychology to give us the deeper answers of life and meaning, that's when it can become a fraud. It can become a trap. It can become full. But the problem could be that secret of contentment that Paul's really talking about here, which has to do with the meaning of life. It has to do with a clear conscience, knowing who you are, that you are acceptable to the only eyes that really matter, that you're loved by the only heart in the universe that really matters. So sometimes we blame things, we blame ourselves, or sometimes we'll just blame others, the reason why we don't feel content. Well, you know, I tried belonging to that group or that church even, and, you know, these people really disappointed me. So now I'm just like, I'm backing off now. I gave my heart to one person and they just turned it into hamburger and handed it back to me. I'm not having anything to do with relationships anymore. And then you slowly distance yourself further and further and have less ability. At best, you have marginal relationships and that's it. You don't let anybody in anymore. You're blaming everybody else. You're blaming everybody else. Words, it's sort of like you didn't like the smell of things, so you cut your nose off. You didn't like your heart getting broken, so you make it hard as a rock. I want to tell you something, people. New Yorkers are very good at this. Very good. Nobody's hurting this again. Speak to the hand. Right? You can blame the things and be really cynical. You can blame yourself and be really sad. You can blame others and be really hard. Or you could blame your relationship with God. You could say, there is a God I'm built for who can satisfy these desires. And listen, most of us are already believers here. But here's the thing, gang. We need to remind ourselves that we have the capacity for God, for this deep experience of His love. That, you know what? When you're starting to feel just bummed out and depressed, just remind yourself how big God is. And you have not even really, will never even begin to plumb the depths of what it is to experience His love. We haven't even begun to scratch the surface. And I don't care how many years you've been worshiping or studying His Word. We never have to feel like, well, that's it. I did the Christian thing. Paul said how wide and deep it is beyond our understanding. He was still plumbing the depths of it. You can blame the things, you can blame yourself, you can blame others. But if we blame our relationship with God, which one looks like it makes the most sense? Which one provides the most potential and the most hope? You're going to find better things. You're not going to find a better God. I love how Lewis, and I use this line all the time, but use it again. I just love it. How he concludes the whole thing. He says, listen, you know what it is? God has created us with certain desires. A duck is created with the desire to swim, so there's such a thing as water. A baby is created with the desire to eat, so there's such a thing as food. We're created with the sexual desire. So there's such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. Paul says it's the secret of being content in any and every situation. Last thing. We've seen that contentment's a secret. False contentment is revealed by either plenty or want. Lastly, true contentment is learned. This is huge. It's a process. If it was something that you just discovered, then you'd be here like, what's the matter with me? Still hasn't fallen. Haven't had one of those aha moments, you know? It's a process. It's learned. It takes time, people. Paul didn't just get to this place and say, aha, I found the key. Yeah, he had an aha moment on the road to Damascus, but it was another 12 years before he was put into missionary work. Do you know that John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, had an aha moment? He was aboard a slave ship, and to be in the middle of a storm had to be one of the most frightening experiences. You ever see one of those old ships? I saw Old Ironside in Boston. I mean, I'm thinking, how did they cross the Atlantic on these things, man? And then if a typhoon or a hurricane or something, he was frightened and he had that moment with God. And we all think, yep, that's when he wrote Amazing Grace. You know how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me and he got out of the slave trade. No, you know what happened after that? After that, he got promoted to captain of the ship and he thought, praise the Lord, now I can get married, I can support my wife, you know? It takes time, people. He wrote in one of his journals how he had just gotten done reading the annals of Caesar's wars or something, and he felt really convicted. And you're thinking, really? This is where it happened. He felt really convicted that he was wasting his time reading secular material instead of God's word. While there was a whole boatload of slaves shackled and sitting in their excrement of the bow of the ship, he's convicted because he's not reading the Bible. Of course, the conviction came later. But it took time. It's a process. It's a learned thing. Like I said, the 10th commandment says you shall not. But you know, the 10th commandment is really just a symptom of breaking the first commandment. As a matter of fact, you can't break any of the other commandments without first breaking the first two. Because it says you shall have no other gods before me. And so what happens when we have another God before us is we desire something more or in place of God, and then it says, well, don't covet. Don't covet. Don't get that in the way. You shall have no other gods. Be completely content with God and don't grasp for anything else. There shouldn't be anything you want so badly. In other words, we have to learn how to unmask coveting for what it is. It's a process. Here's the first thing you have to learn to do in your process, gang. If you want to learn the secret of being content, you've got to understand coveting for what it is. It purports to be your friend, but it's your enemy. You feel like you've got to have this thing. You've got to get it. You've got to get it. But guess what? It's going to get you. You're after it, but it's actually after you. I tell you what, we'd be frightened, I think, if we could really see things truly from the spiritual standpoint. You're after this thing. I've got to have it. I'm working. I've got to get this thing. And guess what? It's not that you're just after it. It's after you. You've got to have it, but guess what? It's got you by the neck. And God's saying, don't covet. Don't have any other gods before me. It's going to short-circuit your ability to experience His commitment, His contentment, His commitment to you. Amen? To covet things is to say, if I have them and only have them, will I make it? So anytime you're discontent or angry or miserable, ask yourself, what besides God has taken away my functional trust in God? I'm feeling really depressed right now. I need to just kind of take a moral inventory, a spiritual inventory right now. Is there something that has replaced my functional trust in God? To unmask the coveting for what it is, we'll learn Paul's secret to contentment. Just a couple other quick things. Preach the gospel to yourself. Says David encouraged himself in the Lord. Sometimes you need to just tell yourself, you know what? This thing does not give me my worth. Jesus is my worth. Just to say, you know what? It's not what everybody else says about me. It's what Jesus has said about me. What He thinks about me. Number three, it's a discipline. I read another thing by Keller on this one. He calls it the icing principle. I like that, the icing principle. In other words, don't you love icing on cake? You know, when you're a kid, you take off the icing, right? Throw away the cake. But what if you had icing for breakfast, icing for lunch, icing for dinner? Wouldn't you have to be a medical genius to find out or to at least prophesy that you're going to be in trouble? You know, you've got to be careful about those things. And no protein, no carbohydrates, just icing. See, the thing is a Christian approach is that we're not against pleasure. The Bible doesn't say you must abstain from pleasure. It doesn't say that. It says, but don't worship it. See, there's a balance. You can enjoy these gifts, but you know what you need to do? When you're enjoying something that God has given you, just say to yourself, but it's only the icing. And when you lose one of those things, you say, well, It was only the icing. God's the protein. God's my staple. Learn communion with God. Another one. Learning communion with God. Learning how to enjoy His presence. You say, oh, I've did that and I get really, you know, tired. You know what? Don't settle for that. Don't stop till you learn that prayer is a lot more than what you've already experienced, no matter what you've experienced. Lastly, obey. Listen, God's got all these principles in there for us, all these ideas and these commands for right behavior, because it's for our benefit. Because you know what? You'll never experience contentment with a bad conscience. I know it's all by grace, but you're not going to experience contentment with a bad conscience. It's just the way He's wired us. So He tells us how to live our lives. So it all comes down to this. Do you really think God will fail to fill you when you seek His presence? Of course He won't. Of course He won't. I love what Paul writes a little further towards the end of this chapter, verse 19. He says this, "And my God will meet all your needs according to His glorious riches in Christ Jesus." Trust Him to do that. Just lift up your empty hands and say, "God, fill them." Paul says, "I've learned the secret. I've learned it. It's not in New Year's resolutions. It's in Him. It's in Him." Let's pray. God, I'm just asking that You teach us how to be like Paul. And we ask You to teach us because Paul tells us that we have to learn it. God, we so need to learn it. What a witness we would be if we truly begin.